the podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 37 of If This Is a Podcast and What's Christmas. Today, it's my fifth chat with Dave Nye, and I'd like to thank him for providing about one in seven of my episodes. It's very kind of him, but they're all fascinating. They're all really, really interesting. I think that's why we've done so many, because there's other people who've had great careers in advertising, and you can kind of get through the whole thing in terms of their recollection and what happened in an hour or maybe in a couple of hours. But Dave's got such a great memory for what went on and about the work and about the situations around the work and about, you know, the movements and narratives and all that sort of extra stuff, that whenever I have a chat with him, it does end up being quite detailed, which I love. I think it's great. And this chat in particular, which is another startup-based chat, because we got to the point where he left Abermead Vickers to start CDD. It's got lots of really, really fascinating details that I haven't had from any of the other conversations I've had with other people about starting up. So, you know, there's an enormous amount to sort of learn from this. And as I've said in the blog, I think the point Dave makes at the end to say that whatever situation you have, it's always going to be somewhat unique, is a really, really good observation, because you go, well, if you start up, you follow this rule, that rule, connect with these people, those people, do this, do that, you're sorted. Well, you kind of are and you kind of aren't, because every situation and dynamic has its own set of circumstances, its own luck, its own good fortune or bad fortune or whatever. So you've kind of got to take your own situation as it is and make the best of it. So the CDD story, I think, is really, really interesting, because, you know, there are some ups and downs, some of which were in their hands and some of which weren't. And it as an agency, created some really fantastic work. And as I said, I think, again, on the blog, it ended prematurely. But behind that set of circumstances, or actually behind that superficial narrative, is a lot of very interesting circumstances, which Dave goes into in entertaining detail. So again, you can stop listening to me.
I think of your...
horrifically, I think it is now. It's embarrassing.
Cool. Well, I think the last time we chatted, we were at the point where you were about to depart AMV. And if my memory serves me correctly, you were then going to start up your thing.
You're cutting in and out there, but I think the last time we spoke, we were just thinking about starting an agency, I think.
Yeah.
Was that right? So I guess what happened is whilst we're at Abermead, we'd had a few occasions where the client had asked for me and Sean to work on a piece of business, which I thought was weird, and we hadn't come across that. And then a couple of people said, could we do it? I think it was a launch of O2 with Tom and Walter, and the client had picked the teams, you know. And that happened at BNP once before as well. So it's only really three times it happened in all. But I guess the combination of that and the combination of Mother starting, where their vibe was, we're going to offer a lot of creative resource, not really any account handling, and just people who are going to help the creatives deliver the stuff. But it was very... their sort of manifesto, whatever you want to call it, was very creative focused. And at the time, me, Sean, Tom and Walter were thinking maybe we could set something up that is, you know, because at that point it felt like, particularly with the sort of development of the internet and more freely available information, that clients could get a lot of stuff that previously they would have relied on their agency to get. But the one thing they couldn't get was the creative side. That's the one thing they couldn't get, sort of high-quality creative. A few people at the time had tried to do it in-house, and interestingly now, some of the best creative places, I'd say, are in-house. Mm. At the time, in-house was considered to be the worst of the worst, so no decent creatives would ever go to work direct on one client, and stuff, which obviously changed. So we thought maybe the industry's going that way. Maybe we could start something up with, you know, four creative partners, senior creative partners. And then we thought we would need one incredibly senior account guy who'd done it before, probably quite old, to offset the fact that there was a lot of creative people. So that was the kind of plan, really. And then obviously we would sort of charge slightly different as well, because we wouldn't have quite the overhead, and it would be, you know, we charge a lot for creative, but it would, you know, that was a sort of loose plan at the time. While we were thinking about that, or sort of mulling that over, I mean, it wasn't like a hard and fast plan. We just used to talk about it occasionally. While we were thinking about that, some Italians approached us called Testa, who were, I think, and still are the biggest agency in Italy. And I think someone we talked to them and said that, you know, these guys are thinking of doing that. So they got in touch and said, can we have a chat? So just at that time, Tom and Walt fell out. So then there were three. It was a little bit mysterious as to why at the time. Anyway, so we kind of went into Testa thinking, slightly naively thinking, never even heard of them. Don't know anything about Italian advertising, but it would be rude not to go and have a chat. So we went in to have a chat, and they had a little micro office in London that they said, why don't we do a startup in London? You guys can run it. We've got the sort of basis of something to get going. Just tell us what you want in terms of people, money, whatever the deal is. They were very, they were saying, tell us what you want to do it, and we'll kind of make it happen. So before we knew it, we were sort of going down that track. So, I mean, interesting for me, you know, you've talked to a few people about doing startups. Most of the people I know who've done startups have almost done them by accident. It's not, you know, Mother, for example, I think came about because Robert had won Channel 5 when he was at GGT, and then GGT said, actually, we've just won Blockbuster, you can't do it. So it forced him to think, well, what do I do? And in the end, he set up an agency. And lots of agencies come about through a sort of spark that isn't all pre-planning and everything's perfectly organised. It's something happens and all of a sudden you find yourself running an agency. It's surprisingly common. That's how ours started, yeah.
So the other question was, when you're talking about the makeup of it, did you not think financially it was going to be difficult to cover the salaries of three or four very senior creatives when you began, and an account guy and all that kind of stuff? Or was that not something that entered into it?
Well, we wouldn't have thought about that. I mean, I think that when we're all very senior at Abbotmead, and you kind of get slightly deluded, you know, how the business works. And of course you don't. You know how the creative department works, and you know how ads work, and you know your bit of it. But in terms of running a business, we didn't have a clue. You know, we just thought, we can do the creative bit, and we can do that to a good standard, and I'm sure the money will get sorted out. You know, there wasn't much of a financial plan. And I think, you know, if it had been us four plus a very senior account man starting with no outside backing, then I guess we would have got to the point where we would go through the, you know, more of a financial plan and go, well, do we not pay us, you know, do we not pay ourselves for 6 months, or what? Or do we pay ourselves £10 a week, or whatever the thing is to get through the early days? But because we had backing from Testa, which was like a really rich, big, successful place in Italy, that wasn't an issue. I mean, it wasn't an issue to such a point that we, you know, we would sit there and think, all we would think is, how do we create the best creative agency we can? So, you know, we approached a few, the best TV planners we could. We approached the best typographer we could, which was Dave Wakefield, and you know, we paid him a six-figure salary then. You know, we didn't think about finance, and they were perfectly happy with us not thinking about finance. We just thought, let's get together the best team we can, start doing work, start pitching, and I'm sure it will come together. I mean, in retrospect, it's unbelievably naive, you know, because we weren't 12 and 13. We were grown up at the time. But you know, saying that, I think by the time we started, I mean, I think that I suppose the thing I come away from, having done it a couple of times now, is the vibe is the possibly the most important thing. So I would have gone into that thinking a bit more scientifically, thinking if we get the best this and the best that and the best there, then you can't fail. And obviously that's important to some degree, but how you get on, the kind of vibe, whether you're all feeling positive or negative, all of those soft issues that sound a bit bullshitty at a certain point in your career, you realise they're actually probably more important to some degree. You know, I didn't stop going into meetings with EAR for the next 10 years where I would hear stories. Well, at CHI, of course, they've all got nicknames, and in the meetings they'll say, oh, you know, Bosher, pass that to Jezza, and Jezza, give us the... And you think, God, is that what we've got to come up with nicknames for ourselves to try and pretend that we're all best mates? But I think that the truth of that is that when you go in for chemistry meetings and as a client, if it feels like a gang and they all like each other, it's a nice place to be than if it's, you know, I mean, not particularly that our meetings would have been frosty, but that's disproportionately more important than we would have thought going in. So God, I've got a bit distracted there, so I can't. But yeah, but so our start point would be, let's just get all the best people we can get in, and just start pitching and making work, and that was it. Yeah.
Just going back to that, you were asked a few times to work on a specific piece of business, which, in my experience, that's incredibly unusual in a normal agency setting, but it only happened a few times. I mean, I think this goes into an interesting issue about whether clients 100% would know and value the fact that they had this sort of utter super team of creatives. Because from my point of view at that time, it was like, oh my God, like the best TV creative of the last 10 years is joining up with, you know, guys who've done some of the best print in the world over that time as well. This is never going to do anything but to succeed in the most incredible way. But I wonder how much clients knew about you guys and would be swayed by, you know, that level of creativity.
Well, I think, you know, I think that being asked to work on by being asked by clients to work on their business at BNP and Abbott Mead, you know, rather than it being a trend, was, I think, just a couple of weird, oddball occasions, really. I mean, at the time we thought, well, maybe that's a trend where the clients are just focusing more on, they can, a lot of them sometimes turn up with their own strategy. There's a lot of stuff that they can do themselves, but they can't cast the creatives. And actually, you know, I remember Tom Carty always used to talk about creatives. There should be a sort of agency like there is for actors that handles creatives, and you go there and you kind of get cast for certain jobs and you get kind of crazily well paid because they can choose exactly who they want to answer a particular, which is a good idea. But so I don't think that was a trend. And you know, even Mother over the years changed from not having account people to having account people. That's the way it seemed like it was going. It's funny, I met some people last night and they're all talking about perhaps sort of the same thing, not in relation to what we did, but just perhaps creatives could be, you know, that's the only bit that the clients can't do, and they're having to pay, you know, all the sort of costs at the moment are getting drained out of agencies, but the core, when push comes to shove, the things that the client really needs is a piece of creative work to run in whatever media is kind of booked. So I don't know. I don't know. Maybe it'll change. But it wasn't really a trend. You know, we thought it was a trend. There's a planner saying, isn't there, about, I can't remember what it is now, about how many occurrences make a trend, and other than that, it's a coincidence.
Talking planners, I was just going to say that, you know, your plan in setting up was you guys and an account person. but you haven't mentioned a planner. Did you just not feel that was necessary? Do clients come with their own strategy more often than not?
No, I mean, what we did, so in that instance with Tesla, so we had probably one of the three most famous account people in the business over the last 30 years to that point was toying with doing it. And in the end, he said, I think I'm probably just too old for another startup. And I won't say who it is, because... So he would have been key, you know. He was, and we sort of started off thinking that's the crucial bit: someone who's totally viable, believable, trustworthy, going to offset, you know, he's going to sort of stand up to this argument that there's lots of creatives, or four or three as they ended up, but you know, don't worry, I'm sort of been there, done it, and I'll tell you why this is an amazing idea. So then, in that process, he kind of said, I can't do it, I'm too old. So we then looked for the best planner we could find, and we interviewed lots of planners, and we plumped for Alison Hode, who was then head of planning at Lowe's. I think Lowe's had been ad agency of the year. She was pretty young, she was very bright. And she took a chance and kind of threw a lot in with us. So we then had a planner. Didn't really have the person running it that we needed. We had the head of new business we took from Abbott Mead, who was like the youngest person ever on the board at Abbott Mead, and he was the head, youngest head of new business that ever had, which is Casper.
Yeah.
I'm sure you remember.
I do.
But we still had really, I mean, particularly in retrospect, but even at the time, it felt like there was this big gap. So I think at some point, we started with Tesla. They started to strong arm us about certain things in the contract that we hadn't signed. It was like Darth, and we didn't have a clue what we were doing. You know, certain things that we should have signed this clause saying they could sell their shares in London to anyone. And at the time, that seemed unfair to three naive creatives thinking, like, well, if it's someone that we don't like or we don't want to work for. But essentially, they were putting up all the money and taking all the risk. And anyways, but the way they handled it was a bit awkward. It was, we weren't used to being sort of pushed around and shafted a bit, really. I mean, which once you start, that becomes, you get a bit more used to that. But at the time, you know, you're used to sort of having a bit of leverage and sort of people are probably managing you a bit. So that led to us, I mean, what a bunch of idiots. That led to us pulling out of Tesla within a month. So basically when we'd announced in campaign we were setting up this agency and we're doing it with Tesla, we had a tremendous amount of people came forward and said, "Now, well done, but you shouldn't be doing it with them, you should be doing it on your own, or I would have backed you, or we would have backed you," or something. There's a lot of it wasn't particularly against Tesla, but that a lot of people who'd done it just thought it was the wrong move. So anyway, so we started talking to other people about whether we got new backers. At this point, we've probably got about 10 people we've hired. We've hired, you know, lots, all these fancy people that the best people we could find, with barely any, well, no business really. And we then spoke to various people about backing us, and there was quite a lot of interest. So just as we're having those conversations, we're in a meeting pitching for Gordon's Gin. So this might bounce all over the place. I'm trying to remember it. But just to get rewind a bit, the thing that I was going to say about the vibe is crucial. So when we started, although we were completely clueless and knew nothing, we were incredibly confident and positive and having a good laugh. So when we would pitch for things, there's a few things we pitched for Gordon's. The feeling was we were bound to win this. And that's a good place to be when you're pitching. You don't want to be overly arrogant, but you want to feel like, not be desperate. You want to feel like, yeah, this is probably going to happen, this one. Anyway, so we were pitching for Gordon's. And then as I was kind of going through the work, I could see everyone milling around one of the rooms looking at a TV. And this is just when we sort of negotiating to not have testers back in, which we'd sort of agreed. And then when the meeting ended, I was thinking, what the hell are they all looking at? And I could see, whilst at the same time as people were looking at the TV, which was sort of distracting me and making me wonder what was going on, I also noticed out of the big windows at the back, occasionally there'd be people hugging each other and someone would be crying. You know, like sometimes you may see that in the street and you think, oh, I wonder whether they've just heard someone's died or that one of the parents has died. So it just felt like a weird vibe. Anyway, the thing ended. I think it was like an interim, you know, meeting, not the final meeting on the Gordons. And we watched the planes going to the Twin Towers. So, obviously, you know, unbelievably shocking, probably the most shocking thing, moment I can think in my lifetime. And there was a lot of, you know, there's a lot of stuff going around the time, not just that, about how would the Chinese react and what's going to happen here, there, and everywhere. It's like, now we're a month into an agency that we're just pulling away from. I mean, it's just a nightmare in timing. So we end up talking to, so this good vibe that we've got, where because we had an unusual, we got like three front pages on Campaign in a row. And I think it was because it was different, you know, it was like, possibly stupid, but it was like a different thing, you know, a load of creators are going to set something up and we'd come up from Abbott Mead, which is one of the biggest, most successful company at the time, arguably one of the, well, certainly one of them now, but it was the number one place at the time. Anyway, so all of a sudden that vibe was not quite as upbeat as it was. So we went through the motions of, we spoke to Martin Sorrell and John Wren and various other individuals who either said, come and work in our basement and fund it yourself, and or they'd say, we'll put up this much money, or, you know, WPP and Omnicom had different ways of structuring and doing things. Ultimately, we thought, we saw John Wren, and the thing we liked, one of the things we liked is that he said he hasn't got many independent agencies in the network, just Goodbiz, may have been another one, I can't remember, but if it was, it was a good one, and Goodbiz, and he could hook us up, and he said, and I want this deal to happen, I'll make it happen over the weekend. So we thought that'd be great, we'll be sorted by Monday. And that ended up taking, so we went with him, stood everyone else down, and that took 3 months. So I don't know whether that, I don't know what that weekend chat was about, or whether the sort of unspooling of the 9/11 affected things, but it went on for 3 months. So in that 3 months, we had nothing to do. So we'd been used to, so we'd gone from being incredibly busy at Abbott Mead with queues at the door most of the time to being all kind of giddy and upbeat and pitching and stuff's happening to sitting in our friend's boardroom with all the expensive people we'd hired with no agency or anything to do. And this is like post 9/11, which is stressful enough as it is, without any work issues. So... again, in retro, you know, it's a slightly different time now. I mean, this is the end of 2001. I think if that was now, you go, well, let's just start the agency. If it's me, I'd go, let's start the agency in this boardroom. The minute we win a couple of clients, we're away. At the time, it's partly us not thinking correctly, and partly because it was a slightly different time to how it is now, where everything is a little bit more mobile, not quite as fixed as it was. You think, well, if we haven't got a building, we can't really operate. Which sounds so daft now, because we had all the people, we had all the functional components, and we had a lot of interest. And the fact that we was in this building rather than that building, or we didn't have a name on the door, whatever the issue was, is just crazy. But we thought, well, we can't really start. So we should have just carried on pitching. I think we even pulled out of the Gordon's pitch, and we were told we were due to get it, we had the best idea. I don't know whether that was true, that's what the client said afterwards. And obviously, we should have just carried on. I don't know what would have happened if we'd have been awarded the business and we're in a boardroom and how you manage that. I'm sure it's manageable.
Yeah.
But essentially, we then were in this boardroom for 3 months, absolutely stressed out of our heads. And also, we couldn't just think, oh, fuck it, let's go back to other mood. Partly because we'd pulled a load of people out of jobs, you know.
Yeah.
And at that time, post 9/11, it was awkward. You know, the people were sort of buttoning down the hatches and not, you know, it might have been awkward for them. So we had to sort of just kind of tough it out and kind of, you know, I used to come in a suit to the boardroom to do nothing all day. To look like I was sort of in control of something. Don't know how much that suit helped. And then eventually we did a deal with Omnicom, and at the same time we were sort of introduced by Peter and me to Mercedes and went for a series of meetings in a kind of, I would say it's like a pitch, it was like a sort of proposal of what might we do and what did we think some of their issues were. Because the main guy, not necessarily the marketing guy, but the CEO who knew Peter, was really unhappy with the work. So essentially we had a few meetings where one of the things that they had at the time was this line that now because they started making, they've gone from two models to like 10. So someone had come up with this line, now there's a Mercedes for everyone, which was true because they were all in all shapes and sizes. But we said, well, essentially you've gone from being really special to really ordinary. It's like Ford now. It's like you don't want a car for everyone. You want, you know, you want it to be special. Whatever, you know, even if it's like the lowest end, if it's like 12 grand, you still probably, arguably, the badge is worth more to those people than the people spending 100 grand because it's no, you know, it's less of a big deal. But people getting a bit of Mercedes at 12 grand is quite important. So you've got to make them feel special, not say, oh, any old idiot can have one now because we make all different sizes, which they agreed with. And then we sort of were given that straight away. Then we, because again, post 9/11, the building situation with Omnicom was we can't undertake any more leases. So we've got one in Primrose Hill you could lease. You've got one in Marble Arch and one in the Strand, in part of Interbrand. So we had a look at all of those, went for this big, lovely building in Primrose Hill. And then we started.
Cool. I think one of the questions I asked Tom and Steph, and I'll ask it to you because you're in a slightly different scenario, is how did you know, like, just as a basic thing, how much to even charge Mercedes for what they were doing? Did someone else know that, or did someone in your team have an idea?
I would imagine that Peter worked with them on that. I mean, essentially, they had an amount of money they were paying DDH, and it was that, which was a good amount of money. I mean, they had a really weird structure, which is essentially they had something like £3 million, and £1.5 million was to, it might have been just more than that, but it was that ballpark. So, and it was divided like this. You've got £1.5 million fee, and you've got £1.5 million to actually commission and make all the ads. So your TV production and your your photography shoots and whatever you had to outsource had to come from that bit, and the fee had to come from that. And they said if you balance that how you want, if you get through the year and you haven't spent it all, then that's fine. But which is incredibly trusting and surprising, particularly for a sort of button-down German company. But so that was that. So I mean, so we started with that. But the thing I was going to say about the vibe is that having sat in a room stressing and worrying for 3 months, the minute we started, we were sort of slightly comatose. You know, we were sort of a bit, we got a meeting booked in again through Peter Mead for McCain's. He said, you've got to come in and see these guys. They're really good. Hassled her to come in and see us. And that sort of carefree, confident, it's all going to be great vibe had completely, we were all stressed, you know, through world events and the fact that we literally were at, just not doing anything. It was, almost one of the most stressful things. So she came down and we were like zombies. You know, she's sort of chatting and we're sort of grunting, going, you know, not really, not at all, just out of it, really. It seems weird now. So then she went, and the feedback we got was, why the hell did you get me to come down from Gunthorpe or wherever it was to see those guys? They were useless. and that's horrific. So our vibe was, and we were in this massive big building with no energy and just sort of stressed and, A, relieved that we'd finally started, but just not functioning properly, you know. So I said, oh, look, we've got to exercise that. We can't, it's just a really awkward way to start, and it's sort of embarrassing. It's just, we've somehow got to turn that right and make that good. I think we can't move forward with just sort of ignoring it and thinking, well, we'll try and be better next time. We've got to somehow turn that negative into a positive. So we said, look, do you think you could get her in again? It's just unlikely. So she came in again. God knows how that was done. And we thought, well, what, the only thing we knew how to do to try and turn it round is to do work. We thought, well, let's just try and, what's their overall brief for McCain? What issues have they got? Let's just do loads of work. That's the only way that we knew that we could function. We couldn't think, next time she's in, let's be really upbeat and happy, and I'll call you Smiley, you can call me whatever. so we kind of just took it on as a brief. So she was coming in again, and then when she came in, we sort of did a presentation, and she loved it. So she'd come in initially with the prospect of giving us a sort of 250 grand piece of fee on one of the McCain's products, which, and then was appalled and said it was a waste of time. So then she went back to her boss and said, I want to move all of the McCain's business into this agency. And he quite rightly, but unfortunately, said, well, hang on, you said they were useless 2 weeks ago. Now all of a sudden you want to give them everything. And she said, yeah, because I think that, you know, I liked what they did and blah, blah, blah. So he was the sensible one and said, well, give them something and then let's see how it goes. Let's not just flip-flop from one to the other and give them everything, which is a bloody shame because it was a big account then. Mm. It's like another 15, 20 million account. But so then we got a piece of that. So that's two. Yeah, so then we had two. But and then that because we got it, sort of like we exercised that ghost and it sort of kicked us into gear a bit, really.
Cool. Can I just ask one more technical question back to the Mercedes fee? So if you've got $1.5 million and you're going, well, you did a campaign, a print campaign with Nadav to do the photography, and then there was a TV ad involving Michael Mann and Benicio del Toro. How are you like mentally dividing that up? Do you know how many campaigns you're supposed to do? And are you balancing Nadav's fee against Benicio's fee and all that kind of stuff? And who's managing that?
Well, we that would be obviously per year, and and we did a tremendous, you know, literally, we did. I'd say in the first year we did, me and Sean probably wrote about 100 ads, because initially, again, because we, and again, stupid thing to do, we thought, well, we've got three senior creatives, so we can't justify getting a young team or some more help, because. But obviously you then find yourself writing every single ad. So me and Sean particularly wrote like 100 ads, you know, millions of campaigns, and they all ran, and it was, and we did some nice work. And then we sort of started to bring in more people. But essentially what would happen in the first year, the fee that we had to divide across the year, of course, we all found a great way of spending it, all of it, by doing Lucky Star, which I think as an agency, we had to throw in an extra 30 grand to get it made of our own cash as well. I think there was vaguely remember a board meeting where we were 30 grand short. And I guess we thought, well, it's an investment. But yeah, so most of it got swallowed up by that. So there wasn't much of a, again, it wasn't very, you know, we didn't divide it up monthly or look at the media schedule and, you know, most of it went in that. I guess as the years went on, obviously you got a bit more of a sense of what was probably going to be needed and it probably worked out. It was probably spread a little bit more evenly. So things like the Nadev campaign, we did, I think, in year two or three or something.
All right. But so now you've made the McCain's lady happy and you've got a good client for Mercedes that's paying you a lot of money. Is that all systems go in the right direction, or was there any kind of worry at that stage, or was it all good?
No, I think at the time that was all. The first year was really good. I think, you know, we'd started at the same time as VCCP and CHI, and I think by the end of the first year, we probably had as much business as they did, although I'm sure probably O2 paid more than Mercedes. But more or less, we had a big account, which was ours, was Mercedes, and then a few smaller ones. We had McCain's, and then we won the McCallan, I think, in the first year. Maybe Adams as well, I can't remember. So I think by the end of the year, we'd had about four accounts that were nice, you know, Adams, Mercedes, McCain's and McCallan, all M's for some reason. And then, so at that point, it was sort of good. So it felt like there was these three agencies that set up, were all about neck and neck, and we did really well in the awards. I think in the first year, we got quite a lot of work in D&ED, and we got two pencils. And that, we thought, well, that's a good start. Second year was sort of okay. We got an enormous, I mean, we got 70-something ads in the D&AD. I designed the D&AD that year, and we put a sticker on it saying, you know, something like, check out our work on pages, and then it listed it. Okay. And that's fine, it's to be flash. So that was, you know, so I think at that point it was going pretty well. But what, ironically, the struggle that we would have is that when we pitch for things, we had two issues. One is that they would say, well, how do we know we'll get as much attention as Mercedes, which is, you know, it's, what can you say to that? I mean, I'm sure if there was Johnny Hornby was here, he would know exactly what to say. But we didn't really know. We'd say, well, of course, we treat everything with, we want to do the best work on everything, which was true. But somehow that would be off-putting. I guess they must have been smaller than Mercedes. So that was an issue. I mean, one of the other issues, which was a weird one, is that we would get all our combined work together, and then we'd show people when they come in for creds, and they go, have you got anything you've done a CDD? And we go, well, no, we only started like last week. And they go, oh, really? Oh, Jesus. Okay. We go, we did all that. And they went, yeah, but that was at Abbott Mead or BNP or... nothing that you've done here, no? We go, oh, no, we've only just started. I go, oh, God. So you think, well, what do you do there? You can't throw it away. And that would be an issue for some people. The fact that we had one big client, I don't know whether the perception was even bigger than it was, but that was a sort of issue. So I think we, then in year two, we had a lot of chances. You know, we had a lot of decent chunky things like Sky and FedEx and ING and you know, they're all 10 million plus accounts, but we didn't land any of them. And I think one of the issues that we had at the time was that me and Sean would work together on a campaign, and Walt would work on a campaign, and we would do very polar opposite things, you know. So at the time, before we'd kind of resolved how we worked, how we functioned as an agency, I would have to go into the pitch and essentially would say, so we've been thinking about your issue, and we think there's two ways you can go at this. two very opposite ways in this instance. There's this big, poetic, expensive way, which could be amazing, and then there's this sort of bit less expensive, funny, simple thing, and yeah, I mean, there's, that's the sort of ways that we think could both be good. And they go, okay, interesting. What do you prefer? And of course, having done one of them, I'd then have to not say, well, obviously that one. I'd go, well, difficult to say. I mean, they both have their merits. I think this is good because of this, and this is good for that. I think we'd really have to understand a bit more about, you know, blah blah blah. So I couldn't quite go. Well, reinsurance, obviously, that's the better one. And it, you know, it's hard to. So it was hard. So it was tricky. Tricky negotiating that little bit of, you know, I don't suppose it's politics. I don't know what that is, politeness. Because often with, you know, Tom and Walt's work, particularly, when you would see things in its early form, you'd have no, it wouldn't relate to the end result. Sometimes the end result would be amazing, but you wouldn't see that off the first couple of scripts or scribbles. So initially we would try and keep things very evenly balanced, and that was obviously not good in a pitch. If someone says, "What do you recommend?" or "What's your favourite?" So I think we got to the point where there was a sort of board meeting, and people said, "Look, someone has got to be in charge of the creative work, and we think it should be you." So
who's in that board meeting? Who's saying that?
It was the non-creative people. So it wasn't me. So we were all in it, me, Sean, Walt, and it was the sort of Alison, Casper, maybe some others, you know. So it was the non saying, we've got to sort that out, and this is what we think we should do. So I think it was deemed I was probably the most sensible. It was sort of like, right, so you're sort of creative director. Which, of course, then comes with its own problems because part of the reason for doing that is so that you get clarity, so that there's like clear direction, and we pick a recommend. And the downside of that is you're then telling one or two people who are equal partners and in the same department as you, that it's not their work, it's this work, or it's not the one that they think, it's this one. Because we tried to do it democratically and got to a standstill. So then it was me saying, I think it's this one is the best. And obviously you try and do it in a way where you're not, where you're sort of respectful and you give people as much space as possible, or you say, look, why don't you just do that pitch on your own? And so you try and sort of manage it, but you still sort of hit bumps in the road. You know, I'd go to the meetings on Mercedes and you know, sometimes they'd say, look, we still haven't seen a script on the M-Class. And I know Walt is, you know, he's got something he's nearly there with, and I'd sort of stall and stall. And it gets to a point, I go, Walt, come on, is there anything that you can give us a clue? I've got to see them again on something else. I know they're going to mention. Can you give us anything? And I remember once he said, well, I'm thinking about an Indian up a mountain. So I said, okay, right, what? So I'm difficult to say too much more than that. So I'd go, well, I'm not, unfortunately, you could get away with that, Walt, because you can somehow weave that sort of mysterious, enigmatic. I can't pull that off. Say, it's an Indian, he's up a mountain, tap my nose and go, we'll be in touch with it more developments later. I just couldn't. So, yeah, it was awkward, you know. And then I guess also what happened with me and Sean is that we'd started off at Ligas Thedaini, we'd be locked in a room, scribbling away, sort of competing with each other to do the best thing, and then we'd leave the office as a sort of joint team and then sell it. To the more, when I became head of art, then I'd just get more people coming in the office and have to do more things. Then we sort of creative directors at different places after that, and then you've got not only creators coming in, you've got account people and planners. And then when at CDD, when it was me doing the creative director thing, then it was just dealing with a whole bunch of things all the time. So he'd end up working outside in the coffee bar or in the reception or wherever, So then there becomes a sort of divide between us that we're not really functioning as a team. I'd be thinking, oh, we need to do so much better. We need to do so much better. We need to win business. We need to do that. We need to do this. So I would be working. And because I would be dealing with the clients, you know, if you go up to Mercedes and they say, we've got an issue with this thing and we want to do some ads on it, sometimes coming back, you think this would be great or that would be great. And so sometimes you'd come back with a sort of answer or an idea. So from my point of view, I think, well, that's good, because I know that that's what they're talking about and I think it'd be really good. And I think sometimes that would come over like, oh, I think he can do it all on his own. You know, why does it have to be his idea? So where you sometimes think you're helping, sometimes that's not seen as help. So that brought up a few issues as we were going in sort of year twos and threes and four.
And where are you getting these pitches from? Because it sounds like you're getting on really good pitch lists and getting the opportunity with some great clients. Was that Casper or was it coming through a different route?
No, I think not really. I think ironically, I think with Casper, he came as our new business guy. We thought we'd been smart getting someone. We thought it's all about new business. And I think he came as the new business guy. And on the one hand, hats off to him, a month in, said, actually, I don't think I'm right for this new business role. accepted. So we said, why? And he went, well, it's different up at me. You know, people phone up, you book them in, and, you know, you arrange the coffee and stuff, play the reel, and have a chat, you know. Whereas here, you've got to track them down, try and persuade them to come in. You know, it's a very different. And he was sort of right, because it was a much more, you've got to make things out of nothing. You've got to hustle. You've got to say, you should come into CDD. And they go, who? And you go, well, it's really good. And they would be obviously new agency. No one's heard of it. It's bloody hard. And that's one of the most difficult skills of starting an agency, you know, getting in the business.
Yeah.
You know, so you're dealing with issues like, will I know any work that you've done? You go, no, we started last week. Okay, I've not heard of you. Don't know any of your work. Why should I come in? So, you know, with there are certain clients where that's attractive, but they're really in the minority. I can't remember what the question is there. I think initially we got a lot of good things because people thought it's sort of interesting, it's a different sort of model, there's some senior creatives. And that got us quite a lot of big things. But unfortunately, we in the year two, we didn't really convert any of the bigger ones. We won some more business, but not anything comparable to Mercedes. And that's where, you know, CHI and BCCP, and not so much BCCP at that point, I think they had an embargo for a bit with O2, but CHI in year two or three started to put on biggish things. And whereas I think ours was starting to be just smaller, sort of interesting, but smaller things. I think we've got Intelligent Finance, which was reasonable size, and a few other bits and pieces, but not, you know, what we needed is some of those things like Sky or IMG or whatever the other ones were.
But you were doing. I mean, we could go off to the side and talk about the work a little bit because obviously you did AdNams at that point. Was that
your American pronunciation?
Sorry, AdNams.
AdNams.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I was going to say. I mean, that seems like in my memory, I think I've read something about it being quite a small sort of family client. Is that the case? And how did that work come about?
Well, that was an interesting one. We got a call from turned out to be the CEO, and he said, oh, I was given your number by John Hegarty. He said he was a friend of mine, and he said, you know, that we've got this brewery, this business, and we want to spend some real money, which I think wasn't, you know, it's like $1.5 million or something, but to them it was a lot of money, for the first time, and John can't handle it because they've got Boddington's, and he recommended you guys. So
lovely.
So, that's a nice start. And yeah, anyway, so we pitched for this thing. I think, you know, it's quite an interesting one because we, I've written about this on my blog, but we went up the, you know, when you do alcohol and particularly beer, you always have to do the brewery tour and find someone who, you know, a little minute difference for their beer rather than another beer, you know, normally involves hops. And I thought, God, nobody's barely heard of them, and who gives a shit about whether it's this hop or that hop or it's 15% of this thing or that. It's so small. I don't see they're even going to get registered. I don't see anyone's going to register who they are. And I kind of also thought from going into supermarkets, buying bits of myself, it's like a wall of, you know, darkly coloured bottles with all weird names. And you don't really know what's what. And you go, well, I'll try the sort of knobbly brown bottle with the picture of the banana on it, whatever it is. You don't, it's a sort of mind fit. You know, it's, yeah. It's all you need to do is sort of think, oh, that's the one that fill in the blank.
Yeah.
You know, you could point to it and go, that's the one that, whatever it may be. And anyway, when we came out, I said, well, why don't we do it on the fact that it's by the sea? Just because the sea is like 200 yards away. That's got to be unusual, isn't it? At least something different. I mean, what's the point in talking about the hops or all that sort of stuff? So there was a bit of a debate about, well, what difference does that make? That doesn't make the brew, that doesn't make the beer taste any better, being by the sea. I said, yeah, but at least you'd think, oh, that's that brewery by the sea. I just don't know. All the other things seem so small and so boring that I don't think you'd even be able to register them. You know, when you go past posters or TV ads or whatever, you just another unknown brewer. Anyway, we went away, did a couple of campaigns, and just thought it'd be, you know, how do we make it look quite classy and quite cool and a bit different? And we did these things where we just said, beer, well, I think it probably started off beer by the sea or something, and then we thought, well, it sounds posher if it says coast, so it said beer from the coast. And then we took little bits of iconography from the beer, like the bottle caps, or and put them like one in amongst pebbles, or one making marks in the sand, like you would see bird footprints, and then there's like little prints from the cap, and all little sea coastal related things, basically bringing together beer and sea in a sort of interesting visual way, and then made them look like some sort of old railway posters from the 30s, those sort of, you know, Skegness is so bracing, or you know, those sort of posters that say, why don't you ever spend the day at the coast, that were always like really upbeat and quite cool. And then we got one drawn up. They looked a bit rubbish in the way I'd drawn them. You didn't get any sort of, they just looked a bit low rent, I suppose. So we commissioned an illustrator to draw one. Went up there and pitched, and they all got up and clapped. And we said, look, you know, essentially our thing was, which is true of all business, but we said, you want to stop trying to pretend you're a big London cool brewer and just be yourself. And what you are is you're a little brewery by the coast. Just be that and don't feel insecure about it. Do that. And anyway, we showed all the work, and there it was like a big room. There was like 30 people or something, but for some reason there was like loads of people, even though it was a smallish place, and they all clapped. I think it's because they felt, oh, that's us in those pictures. That's what we are. We're not trying to, I think it was all their previous work was trying to, it looked like the sort of thing that big brands did but without the budget. It felt like they were playing someone else's game, whereas they all thought, yeah, that's us. That totally feels like us. It doesn't feel like anyone else. So they bought that, and we won that.
That's cool. And then I guess the other thing that to me is very iconic from the time at CDD is Merrydown. How did that come about in terms of winning the pitch? But also, did the idea just easily pop into your head, or was it a bit of a labour of love?
Well, I think it was a weird one. That I think again, that was a piece of business that was, I think Casper knew the client through a family friend. And at the time, Cider was, hadn't gone through the renaissance it is now. I remember the guy who owned the company, Chris, came in for quite a quirky, nice guy, and said, basically, look, this is our problem. At the moment, it's drunk by students and tramps. So, and that's not good. So we want it to have a better image. That's the brief, really. So he said, we booked a load of posters, and can you make us seem a bit classier than that, so that it's not the tramps drink? Because they were doing really badly, and this was before, I'm trying to think what the brand was that you had with ice that sort of seemed to kick the whole cider.
Oh, yeah. I can't remember.
The Irish one. God, it's funny, but I can't even remember. God.
It was on all the time as well. Yeah, I can't remember.
It's funny how they come and go. But it was before that, so people weren't really drinking cider, and it was, anyway. So the issue was, there was loads of posters, like six-sheet posters that were booked, and I think in the meeting, it's one of those like slightly geeky things. I thought, oh, that's interesting. It's like happy, merry down. It's like happy, sad. Sort of silly thing. Just like early when I was saying, oh, we've got three clients, we've got four clients and three of them begin with M. Mm. You think that's not really an idea. It's just a little observation. So I said, look, it's like merry and down means like it's like happy and sad. I think, oh, yeah. I don't know what that is, but yeah, maybe. And then I think I then went on a holiday and some work was done on it, and it was all a bit advertising it. It was all explaining stuff, and I thought, I just can't see that you're gonna take that information in when you're driving past these six-sheet posters, bus stops and things. I thought you need something like the I Love New York symbol or some really loud, simple little thing that you just can't help but take in and look at. Anyway, so I'd remembered that thing, the merry and down, and thought, well, what could do with it? So maybe there's something in that. And then obviously with that added face that was sort of the posters that would work both ways up, and one way you had a glass and it was full and it said merry, and then the other way it was empty and it said down. And I think, there was a bit of anxiety. You think, well, is that a proper idea? What is it? It's a sort of branding thing. I think it'd be quite cool with the pictures. And it's quite different. But it's almost like, at the time, I think, is that not really a proper thing? What does it say? Is it saying anything? But ultimately, thought it's well-branded and it's cool. And if their issue is, it's being drunk by tramps, then putting some stuff out that isn't like advertising that was a bit cooler. There's no pack shots or logos or anything. It's just slightly culty and feels quite confident and cool. So anyway, so the client said, yeah, I love that. It's great. So we were going to do five. And then once you start to get into which illustrators you want to commission, I thought, God, what a shame to only do five. It'd be great to get loads of people. So instead of giving them £1,000 each, I thought, well, why don't we get 10 at £500 each rather than five at £1,000 each? And I thought, I'd rather do that. And if they don't want to do it, fine, we'll find someone else. And it's quite a nice brief. There's no interference, literally. It's an interesting little problem to have. So then I sort of set about tracking down some illustrators. I think from memory, every single person agreed for a minimal fee. God, his name's gone now. Big American illustrator did one. Baseman, Gary Baseman.
Gary Baseman, yeah.
Who's a fortune, and he did one for £500. And we got really good people. And we ended up doing that. I think we did about 45 of those in the end. So every year we'd do a new 10 with slightly different slants. I think one year it was all vintage, so we had all these vintage cider, so it was all old style illustrations and stuff. But yeah, it was neat. It was nice to do. I mean, God, it was easy. A year had come around, and you think, we need another 10. Who shall I get to draw them? And that was more or less it, really. But weirdly with that. From thinking, is that a proper idea? I thought that probably do really well in illustration. don't think it would do well in the sort of idea bit, because it's difficult to say exactly what the idea is. And ironically, it didn't do well in illustration. It got a pencil in best photography and pencil in best, sorry, a pencil in best press and a pencil in best poster, which was surprising. But so I don't know what the moral is there. But we didn't think, oh yeah, that definitely do well. Quite cool, but.
Cool. Well, I don't know if there's like plenty more CDD to talk to. I feel like because we're at a point where CDD is sort of doing well and humming along in its second or third year. I don't know if it would take a while or you even want to get into how it got towards CDD ending. But I wonder if that's a longer story or do you think, do you want to do it now?
I don't mind. I'll do it now.
Let's do it now.
So I suppose on our little graph, if you sort of start with new business, starts really well in year one, bit not so well in, okay in year two, average in year three, not very well in year four. And at the same time, the agencies, you can't help but look around the two others who set up at the same time, are growing like it used to be. And I think, you know, there's a bit of tension. So Sean is working in, you know, someone, one of the account people once came into me and said, oh, I've done, I've redesigned our letterhead. So I said, okay, let's have a look. And she'd C in one corner of the page, D in another corner of the page, and a D in another corner of the page. So we're all in CDD, all in different corners. And that was sort of true. You know, Sean was working. He didn't like being in the room where there was all account people and planners running in and out and different things. So he got to work in somewhere else, you know, the reception area. All sort of working on the next floor, partly doing his film and doing what he's doing. So it became a little bit disjointed. And I think also when you get to, you know, we've gone from not having the first clue to 4 or 5 years in, you know, I could see, thought, this idea of, you know, certainly three creatives is difficult because, you know, it's expensive. And if you're not all functioning properly, people would not come into us for that thing. So obviously most of the best creative accounts are already sorted at really good creative agencies. Most of the accounts on the loose are the sort of problem kids. It's rare that you get a really good creative account up for pitch. You get lots of, you know, innocent will come round every, visit everyone every so often, potentially an opportunity. But it's generally problem things, as a bit of an overgeneralisation.
Right.
It's not that Levi's all of a sudden think, or Nike, or whoever it may be. So anyways, that was sort of difficult, and we were sort of, you know, a bit soul-searching, why aren't we winning more business, why aren't we doing that? And then we had a sort of, we employed a, well, you know, Gav, as a sort of new business person. We sort of took a big punt and thought, maybe we need someone who's a bit louder and a bit more, a bit different to us and a bit more out there to bring in new business. So we've got Gavin, we've got, tried a few things. Anyway, at one point we did a management meeting about what do we do going forward, and we got some outside sort of, I can't think what you call them, some outside people to host it and manage it with different exercises. And one of the exercises was, the first one, was draw a circle and then put, on this big sheet of paper, and then put, firstly, who runs the agency in the middle, and then span out the people from there. So basically put them on that, and whoever's the most involved is in the middle, and then it goes out now. So we all did our things. And I was sort of in the middle of everyone's circles. Okay, that's interesting. And then different people would turn up, varying degrees, going further out. And then they said, right, let's draw one how you think it should be structured. So people did their diagrams. And then first up, one of the creative partners did his diagram, and he said, I think it could be that person there, that person there. And then I thought, that's weird. He put me outside the circle and himself. I didn't know you could put anyone outside the circle. Didn't know they were the rules. Not that I necessarily would have done, but I didn't even know that was allowed. And he said, I think, look, I think I should leave because I'm going to go to New York and do whatever. And I think I put Dave outside because I can't remember what he said. He's caused some tension or something, and perhaps it's better for him. God, how weird. And then another creative person got up and said, I think Dave's doing too much. And he put me outside the circle as well, and himself outside the circle. And he said, and this the other creative person said, oh, well, you know, I think I should be in a big place, you know, bigger than this. I sort of enjoy it more. And I think, I can't remember what the issue is. But anyway, I was outside the circle. And then Casper had got a similar thing. So he was outside the circle, and so was I. So I was kind of a bit shocked because I thought, well, God, I seem to be doing all the work and trying really hard. And so it felt like a sort of, I was carrying things. Anyway, so I was out on the outside of the circle, and then the other people did theirs, and I was somewhere near the middle. So I thought, well, fuck it then, I'll leave. I thought, well, if I'm going to be outside the circle with some of the people I've started with, then I felt a responsibility to them to not leave and get a job, because I thought, God, if I go, it's going to be a real problem because I'm, you know, doing this, that, and the other. And I thought, well, if they're going to put me outside of the circle, then that's going to liberate me. And I think, fuck it, I'll go. So I kind of partly felt liberated and thought, well, I could do what I want then. I can go and get another job or do whatever. And then a little bit later in the week, I thought, no, hang on. All those people said they should go. I don't necessarily want to go. So I went back and we had another meeting. I said, it just occurred to me. You said you wanted to go. You said you wanted to go. You said you wanted to go. I don't want to go. Why don't you go? And I'll stay. Because it's kind of a coincidence that they'd all put me outside the circle, but they'd all put themselves out. It's like weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then that was sort of, then everyone went away to think about that. And I think they preferred the idea of me going than them. So eventually, but I probably should have stuck to that. I probably should have gone, no, I think, you know, I'm not going, but if you're saying you want to go, you should go. So in the end, so I went. Shame, because, I mean, we weren't doing as well as we should have been, but with a bit of surgery, I think we still had Mercedes and some good accounts. We'd done good work. Unfortunately, they changed the name then to Shop, and then in less than a year it closed, which was a complete waste. But I don't know, really. I'm trying to think of a positive learning from that.
Well, I'm sure the whole...
I mean, I guess the learning is, well, you tell me, but I mean, one of them is think it through a bit before you start. Because, I mean, all of those issues that end up coming out like that are from not having a clear plan when you go in. And people do start up by accident. It sounds a bit like with Nell and I, but, you know, there is a bit of things that are not completely worked out. But I think that our sort of casual, fuck it, kind of thing, probably came home to roost a bit. You know, we didn't really have a way of... I think it's one of those things that if we'd have carried on with Testa, where we were all very giddy and upbeat and we'd won some of those things, and then we'd rolled that into some more wins, that if we'd got more business, that would have kept us all fully functioning more, then it probably, we might have sort of got through that. But I think, we needed to be bigger to sort of, you need momentum for a startup or any business. You can't, the minute you start, being static is a problem. So you need that momentum. And I think we sort of lost that in year three, four. And I think then that becomes a problem. And then people sort of look in, what's the issue or who's to blame or whatever it is. But go on, what you tell me the moral. You've heard that little...
It wasn't so much a moral, but I mean, obviously, even though it didn't end up, becoming, a new DDB or something and existing for hundreds of years and being incredible or whatever, obviously, there were lessons you could take from that into whatever happens next. And, as someone who began and ended their own agency within like the space of about 3 years, I'd do it again in a second, because the amount of stuff I learned from that experience, even though there were some friction and some difficult times, I think there's probably friction and difficult times even when you're working in, in a big agency. So the positive I would take from it is what I learned, and I'm very happily get on with the people I did Luna with, and that's all kind of fine and water under the bridge. But I think you're chucked into this crucible of very difficult, interesting, somewhat stressful situations where there's a lot of pressure, there's a lot of people's different opinions coming in, and every little thing matters quite a lot. So, I can understand how just the slightest thing out of kilter can then spin the whole thing off into somewhere problematic. And I think that the thing you're saying about chemistry, I heard that about, and I'm hoping this won't be in any way offensive to those people, but when Tony and Guy started an agency, was it more Blaze Deakins or something? I heard that the chemistry factor there wasn't quite right as well, and clients kind of smell that. It's like dogs smelling fear. They smell, do you guys really get on? But I think you could have done it again in the whole Tesla thing, and it could have been incredibly successful, or it could have hit other sorts of problems. I just don't think it's possible to really put everything in perfect place when you go into it and have...
No, right. And I think there is a lot of, having seen and met a lot of people who've started up, it's the problem is it's not one of those things like making a commercial or something where you can do 100 times and think, I've learned a lot that 100 times. You can't do it very often. So most of the people you talk to who give you advice, they've got an example of one, You may talk to someone and they set up an agency in 1980 and they say, well, what you want to do is X, Y, and Z. And you think, it may be, but it's like, it's a different world. And obviously their chemistry is different. And it's not that, by chemistry, it's not that everybody's happy. Chemistry, you hear horrific stories about some of the most successful agencies about how the partners get on or don't get on. It's just a sort of, it's like bands. I think it's one of those things, if you swapped Ringo Starr and...
Pete Best.
Charlie Watts.
Oh, right.
Who knows? But those bands might both not have done as well as they did. I think there is a sort of weird... chemistry, animalistic thing, and I think you only sort of think that coming out of it. In going into it, you think that's all bullshit, because if you can do the job and you try hard and you're nice or whatever, then how can it go wrong? But there's different dynamics. Sometimes you'll get the tremendous amount of tension between the sort of, let's go with stereotypes, the account man who wants to make tons of money and the creative who just wants to do great work. And that tension and constant argument is a fantastically useful thing to keep both in check and to push both on. And whereas sometimes when you all get on too well, it can be a bit flat, ironically, if you're all agreeing. So there is a sort of physical nature of combustible thing of when you put people together, how that works. And some of that is sort of very hard to predict, so it's really hard. And I think, in retrospect, most of the agencies that break through from boutique to big, they generally have, BBH came out of all the guys doing it together. They had a sort of 10-year dry run, arguably, at TBWA. The guys at Adam and Eve had a decent run at Y&R. I think Johnny Hornby and Clemo had worked together.
TBWA.
TBWA. I mean, they're the three that probably in the last 20 years have grown the most, I think. I don't think who else there is. But so having a functional working partnership in doing the things that you're in, doing the jobs that you're going to do when you start up is useful. So we were probably too casual, I don't know, in terms of how, in terms of going into it, not being, I mean, we just didn't know. I mean, it's not that we didn't take it. See, we worked really hard. We just didn't know, you know, we didn't know what we didn't know. But yeah, I don't know.
Cool. Well, we could go into what happened at DHM in the next thing, because that's obviously another startup, and it'll be interesting to compare.
God, we've done an hour again.
We've done over an hour. We've done like an hour and 10 or hour and 15. So maybe episode 6 could be looking at how. Well, yeah, maybe the next one will be the last one. I don't know, but it'd be interesting. See how DHM differed to CDD and what you did differently based on that. But, you know, we can get into that. Cool.
Okay.
Well, huge thanks.
I'll send you some work, Ben. Yeah, pleasure.
Yeah. Send me anything and everything on CDD that you want me to put up, and I'll do a thing over the weekend, hopefully. So if you got it soon, that'd be really great.
I'll get you a file, yeah.
Okay. Cheers, Dave.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks. Have a good day. Bye.
All the best. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Bye.
Podcast to watch Christmas.